What is the biggest challenge for offload to get to the next level in your current view?
If I had like a satellite view, or if I knew exactly at all times where all the trucks in Australia were, just understanding capacity and understanding with full visibility where they are would allow me to be the most efficient player through AI and machine learning in optimizing freight for all of our clients and for whoever else decides to join us.
Hey guys, today we have a guest which I have been working long and hard to try to get onto our show. His name is Jeffrey Henry, and he heads up a company called Offload. For most of you who are in logistics, you should already know who Offload is. I know of him, but not well enough, and this is why he's sitting in front of me. He's also a very successful capital raiser, let's call it that. I believe for the business, as of last year, you've raised $60 million for the business?
Yeah, 97.2, I think, from memory.
Fantastic, fantastic. When I was glancing through, I guess you can call it your biography or you know, your chronological order, I had a little chuckle to myself. The reason being is I always ask this question. Show me a raise of hands who didn't choose this industry. And invariably, always over 90%. Right? And the one of very few that would say, I wanted to be this, very rare. So when I glanced through, it felt like to me you also stumbled into this industry because you have a finance background.
Yeah. So I stumbled into it, but I decided to stay. So kind of a mix. I've discovered it through a specific job opportunity that I had at HelloFresh. And then I realized that it was actually far more interesting than you're led to believe. So I literally decided to stay, and I started my own company, Last Mile in Logistics. So I must say, financial market was probably my go-to to begin with after business school, and probably what seemed like more fancy and like ticking all the boxes. And then when I've realized the pleasure you have by actually doing something tangible and having a tangible impact, logistics came front of mind. So a bit of a mix for me.
What type of support network did you have around you that fortified you to make the right decisions at the right time?
By the way, I haven't made the right decisions always at the right time.
I've
made a lot of wrong decisions at the wrong time.
Okay.
But not much, to be honest. I've learned through the process. I didn't have a lot of support. I have guidance from mentors that were still from the financial industry. But in Australia, I have no network, right? I'm still an immigrant. I've got a French accent, as you can tell. So my network and my support network isn't here.
Right.
And is not a logistics industry background, right?
And we'll come back to that because I have a few very interesting questions on that exact point you just made, right? Like, because like a fellow immigrant in a country where we don't look, well, you look like a local, but you know what I mean. that comes with its own set of challenges.
Yeah.
But we'll circle back to that point. So the wash up of the Marley Spoon and HelloFresh, locked away, fantastic. You got your first win in terms of your ambitious pursuits, right? I guess all of that, you know, you say you make a lot of wrong decisions. I'm sure we all do. I mean, I'm sure you did your fair share. But in some ways, you achieved your first milestone. And you would have maybe got a handsome remuneration from that experience. Then what made you then come back into it again? It's like, you know, this reminds me of the Godfather scene, you know, when he's sitting at the table and he wants to get out and they just drag me back in, you know. What dragged you back into the industry after having that? You could have gone and done anything else.
Yeah, I tried to. I didn't want to go back.
Right.
I was tired. And especially because a big, big part of the business model was actually to do night deliveries. So we're doing about 130,000 deliveries between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. per week. So draining, you always have issues, whether a driver having an accident. So some of like super operational issues that just keep you awake all the time. So I was like, okay, I'm out.
That's right.
That's a great outcome. Sold, I can get out and do something else. I've tried to. I was the managing director of a edtech company called Zuckel.
Yep.
And I've done that for 18 months. It wasn't my venture. I was like, oh, I don't really enjoy
this. Is the textbook stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yep,
so
okay.
I've done that. It wasn't my thing. I learned a new industry. I've learned that I was an entrepreneur before being a freight expert. But wasn't my thing. I've tried to start my own company. And that was called Jumbea. And had hired a couple of full-time employees out of my own savings from the proceeds. That didn't work out. After a year, I was like, okay, I need to close it, stop the hemorrhage or like the bleeding.
Yes.
And then I've reconnected with one of the major investors that invested in HelloFresh, a multi-billion dollar company, a VC fund, biggest backer of HelloFresh. We made a couple of billion just with HelloFresh investment. The founder and owner of that fund is called Oliver Samuel.
Yes.
And he reached out to me and said, by the way, you're an entrepreneur. We knew you from HelloFresh. We knew you from Be Cool. What if we decided to give you a couple million and you tell us what company you want to launch. You need to be credible as a founder.
Yes.
But we'll give you a couple of million and you start a company and we'll invest in you. That's when I've decided to travel, went to Indonesia, went to the US, went to Germany. And then every time I was trying to get an idea of what I could do, came back to what I knew.
Yeah.
And I knew logistics.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, well, not last mile, it's a niche market still. What is the biggest size of the market? Where is the biggest pool of yes. opportunities? And that was definitely the middle mile. And so I came back to the guy and said, okay, I've got a vision that is at the crossroads between this vision, this part and this part. Do you like that idea? Do you want to back me for it? And he said, yes. And I think from day one, he gave me like, before I even started the company, 1.5 million euros, that allowed me to start hiring a couple of headcounts. Yes.
So you've been dragged back into the industry because somebody wanted to invest in you,
yeah.
okay?
Yeah.
Because of your proven track record with Be Cool. So you're like, okay, I've got to go back to what I know, which is logistics, yeah. right? Because I've got a nice little sweet spot happening over there, mm-hmm. right? And then because this came about in Australia, right? Mm-hmm. You want to get into the middle mile in Australia, mm-hmm. which for those viewers don't know, Australia is super expensive. Right, it's one of the most expensive places for domestic transportation, especially the middle mile. Right, could your model have worked elsewhere, or was Australia always the game plan?
I have a weird way of saying it, but for me, Australia, I call it a fat Switzerland, meaning that there's a lot of inefficiency and a lot of margin. It's a country that has operated with a lot of margin for decades across
right.
a lot of industry, right? There's a reason why a lot of tech companies start in Australia first. A lot of cell phone companies launch their products here first because there's an appetite for change. There has a lot of purchasing powers. Companies are pretty well established and strong financially. And there's inefficiency, meaning fat across mm-hmm. the market where everyone makes a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
weirdly enough, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a competitive market. It's a developed market. It's pretty much standardized in terms of how it operates, but it's pretty much the third world kind of in how mature it is as a market.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where I've anchored, okay, Australia will always be a cash cow,
mm-hmm.
but I will use the profits and the proceeds from Australia to launch other countries. Mm-hmm. And so I actually started from day one, I had two companies. I had Offload Australia and I had Offload Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
But then COVID happened.
Yeah.
And I launched the company in March 2020. COVID happened exactly when we launched. And then I had hired some great ex-McKinsey in Indonesia. I had a team of 8 people. And I've realized either I've cut them loose mm-hmm. and I have to say, sorry, guys, you believed in my dream, but I can't pay you anymore. Mm-hmm. And then have 2 or 3 months of life
yes.
left in
yes.
the business. Or I kept the 2 and only had 1 month. I decided to shut down Indonesia, focus on Australia. And to date, it's been a very good decision, but mm-hmm. it was imposed on me because of COVID.
Right. Well, that segues in a good question. So the plan, you would have had a pretty crystal clear in terms of how you project your growth and where you're going to get your growth from and how and so forth. How has that plan, I guess you've already clued us in terms of you have to change your plan somewhat mm-hmm. because of COVID. Outside of that, has that changed your way of doing things during the COVID years? So during and post, looking at 3 stages, how has Offload's strategic plan mm-hmm. changed and evolved through this COVID experience?
Great question. I mean, I first assumed that I was going to go with a broad product here in Australia, mm-hmm. which is a platform that helps to optimize freight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Between carriers and shippers, and how do we marry them by removing inefficiency? And so inefficiency can be like the fact that 30% of the trucks drive empty, the
yes.
fact that they idle 50% of the time,
yes.
and that there's about 50,000 trucking companies. So there's a big long tail that differs very much in how they're structured compared to big companies. You have one that have zero overhead and you have some that have like 40 cents on the dollar
yes.
being overhead, so bigger trucking companies.
Yes.
So I always told myself, let's go and build a market to solve for those pain points and create value through visibility and through optimization. Mm-hmm. And then let's replicate this model across all of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see whether it's Indonesia, Vietnam, mm-hmm. but let's see where's the next market for us. I've changed that philosophy because there's been a lot of players around the world. I mean, there's Uber Freight in the US. I think they do about 17 billion US revenue mm-hmm. per year. There's Sender in Europe that are valued, I think, 2 billion euros. Mm-hmm. So there's still a couple of players that have been very successful in different markets. And so I don't want to compete. I don't
yes.
want to burn money in order to get market share in other markets. Same is true for Southeast Asia. There's been
yes.
a lot of players. But also I've realized that the most important thing is actually owning the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And to own ecosystem, there's actually more value you can provide down the track, whether it's building a TMS, whether it's providing financial services, and we might talk about that in the future, but we've built a fintech service into our own business, whether it's actually increasing the add-on services that we provide our shippers with, through carbon reporting, through like we're part of a hydrogen conglomerate, mm-hmm. whether it's like analytics dashboards, but we've decided to say, okay, Australia is still $66 billion worth of a market, mm-hmm. right? So let's focus on nailing this market before and until we have a couple of $1 billion revenue. Mm-hmm. It would be a mistake to get outside. It would be the typical startup mistake of getting distracted and chasing every next shiny thing.
Yes.
And so what COVID did to me is focused the vision on nailing it first and not succeeding a little bit and then getting distracted and doing something else, but very much saying, okay, Australia is a proven market where the fundamentals and the economics are there.
Yeah.
We create tangible value for our shippers, for our carriers. We need to expand on it.
Right.
And until we have a saturation point where our growth has an inflection point, we will not leave.
So then by all estimates, I guess, if you're putting it that way, then COVID allowing you to narrow you in on your focus.
Yeah.
Australia, then I would imagine then by that type of calculation is that it's a predictable market with its predictable risks.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're an island to our own. Population is relatively stable. It's probably the least risky option if you're looking around the world today.
I mean, you're spot on.
Yeah.
You're spot on. First of all, the economies are absolutely resilient. When other economies have probably seen two recessions since the 2000s, we haven't seen any yet. So this economy being very much tilted toward commodities always finds an industry that uplifts the rest of the country.
Yes.
And so we're still pretty strong. Labor force is strong. And when I talk to VCs around the world that invest in supply chain and the digitalization of supply chain, they are always astonished towards our economics. We have, and without getting into the details of the numbers, mm-hmm. but we have on average 2 times the gross margin that other peers around the world manage to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some even of Southeast Asian companies have to subsidize because they have to wait until volume reaches a point in which they think they'll be able to negotiate the prices they first came up with.
Yes.
And so they subsidize until volume comes in. We've never subsidized. We've always managed to create value beyond having to subsidize our freight rates in order to attract big shippers, though our clients are massive multinational FMCG players.
Right. Are you finding much friction from the status quo, the existing players in the market? Because Australia is a big country town.
Yeah.
And I really mean that when we say this, when you deal with truckers, right? You've got many first name, surname companies out there that drives their 5 trucks doing one route, and that's all they do. You know, they don't care about anything else. They know every pothole between that place and that place, but they won't care about anything else. And you're right, albeit a lot of our populations are centralizing some major cities, but you've got to do a full coverage if you want to be a truly reputable domestic carrier. How do you fight that battle?
Honestly, it's hard because the town spirit that you just mentioned, right, creates 2 main issues. The first one is the fact that everyone knows each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, going back to the point I've made, I don't have a very Aussie accent. I'm not an Aussie bloke. I haven't been a supply chain director in a massive FMCG place where you now know all of your peers across the industry. And so it's baby steps towards making a dent and being known and being respected and being credible in the market overall.
Yes.
And that's on the shipper front. And so there's still an uphill battle there to be known and to be respected and to be credible and for the brands to trust us, because supply chain is core, right? Every single thing, the mic I have, the t-shirt I have, and everything you wear or everything we touch has been on trucks or boats or everything. And so it's core and essential for all of our clients that that process goes well.
Yes.
And so there's a trust thing that takes time to build.
That's right.
And as you said, as a town spirit thing, you trust someone you've known for 20 years, but not someone you've known for 2 years. And on the supply side, all of the trucking companies know each other, right? They all park of the same groups, they all talk to each other, they all subcontract works to each other. And so being able to build trust across those two sides of the market is something that takes time.
It's a lot of legwork.
It absolutely is, and it's patience I don't have, in the sense that it takes years. Some brokers have waited 20 years in order to get to the point they are.
Yeah.
Not because they're not efficient, but because it takes time to build the right contracts, the right relationships. And that's part of the reason why I've gone onto the M&A strategy, right? I've acquired a business called CIA Logistics.
Yeah, 35 years in the business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here I've acquired clients that I would not have moved otherwise. I've acquired a network of carriers that would not have moved otherwise. We are in early stages yet to talk about it, but we are in the process maybe of looking into buying another company, which again buys me capabilities that takes time to acquire.
Yes.
Mentioning again the town comment you've made.
That's right.
And acquire shippers that are risk averse, or their appetite to actually have digital transformation low and takes time. And because I don't have time, and I know that in order to get a network effect, meaning the amount of volume I have helps me being relevant. The more volume I have, the more I'll optimize it, the more I understand the predictability of freight and so on. And so I need to force me to get to a point in which I have a lot of visibility on the freight movement in Australia. I do that organically, but I supplement it inorganically to counter the town effect.
I think the town effect we talked about is one big black hole.
Yeah.
Right, because if you talk about needing to build relationship with every town, every supplier in Australia, it will take you two lifetimes, and you'll probably not even be successful.
Okay. Sadly,
that's the reality, right? Yeah. And I think the only short circuit to that problem and conundrum is the way the greater community that we are, let's just call Australia for now, is how we do business together. Mm. And the elephant in the room is tech, and more tech, right? So if the end user, the customers, only transact based on a certain technology standard, let's just call it that for argument's sake, and they will only accept that, then I guess all of these town folk or what have you, seeing the tide turning, would have no choice but to go, okay, well, either we go design our own tech and try to plug in, or we work with someone who's already got the platform. I would imagine that has to be one of your fundamental selling points.
It absolutely is. And that's why we focus. I mean, we are about 140 plus employees as we speak. Almost half of that is tech and product.
You're right.
It's building the core, building the platform, building something that creates value across all users, whether you're a driver, whether you're an operator and have a trucking company, or whether you're a large FMCG company, like a Noumi, for example, or like a Nestle that are clients of ours. So we have to create those platforms in order to meet the increasing demand that they have for integration, for visibility, increasingly so, by the way, for, as I mentioned before, carbon reporting and tracking and offsetting. And we also have to create something else on the other end. Australia is not mature, meaning that there's not a lot of transport management softwares in the market. So in order to meet and to be able to tackle the needs of the smaller trucking companies, we need to provide them with the technology as well.
Yes.
So we invest on their behalf in order to build a platform for them. All of that in time will be sufficiently compelling for people to come to us.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are still early in that journey. And so meaning that our service level, our rates, our customer experience is still extremely important and core to who we are. And of course, beyond that, we provide the technology. But we are a service provider. We act as a carrier for all of our clients. At the end of the day, we're only as good as the last shipment. And we need to make sure that the network we have in order to fulfill the freight needs is the best one in the market. Beyond technology, there's still a core that is a truck and a truck driver moving freight. And a lot of fancy companies forget that, right? They think tech as if it's the entire solution. Mm. Well, no, there's still a human being in a truck moving freight from point A to point B. And you need to make sure that you don't forget that, first of all, and you create value on top of this. But if that fails, your technology is irrelevant. So there's something core that we need to not forget. That industry is still manual. And we just need to supplement it with technology, but not replace it altogether. There will be that component that will stay for the next decade. We can debate when autonomous trucks will come in.
It won't happen for a very long time.
It won't happen for a very long time.
You know, it's funny you say what you just said. You and I think exactly the same, you know, because I think a lot of companies out there now, especially the larger ones, are building technology to replace the workforce. And as a logistics guy, in the middle we go, hang on, I'm going to replace my own job. It's not going to happen. So the word we like to do, instead of replacing, we retool our people, right? By building smart tech, then we leverage how we can better utilize these experts in their field. Because at the end of the day, when technology shuts down, you're still going to need someone that knows how to drive a truck or write something down manually, right? So that has to work in sync. And this is our philosophy at TGL. And we really believe in that. Right, we don't believe in just replacing for the sake of replacing. So tech, you are right. It's the biggest catchphrase of the last 2 years during the COVID, because every VC and the proverbial donkey we wanted to invest in tech, and especially to disrupt this industry. Has that worked in your favor?
It would be silly not to surf on a wave that is just in front of you, right? Especially if you're a keen surfer. For us, the wave was COVID, VCs having deep pockets, and us being in an industry that is going through transformation rapidly because everyone was working remotely but didn't have the tools to manage operations and supply chain. So it forced change.
Yes.
So yes, I've ridden that wave. Have I done it carefully? Yes. Have I managed to keep focus on building something healthy and not shiny for the investors? Yes. And to your point, right, like there's two parts of what I usually tell my different clients, right? I tell them there's one idea that for sure, every single company out there has multi-million dollar payroll of logistic people internally. When you're an FMCG player, you have dozens of headcounts, which quickly goes in Australia into a multi-million dollar payroll.
Yes.
And so all of those guys are trying to do the same thing, being the most efficient possible. Mm-hmm. So when you centralize that force and that capability, you kind of allow those people to create value. Because managing freight on a daily basis is essential, but it's not value creation. But if they focus on something else, they will start creating more value for their own clients. And so they can sell more. And so it's not just saying, oh, you're going to save headcounts because you'll be able to cut them. It takes less time for them to manage freight. We're saying, no, you're going to be able to move their focus towards something that creates more value for your own business, that will then attract either saving somewhere or then upselling somewhere else.
Right. And how do you go about in discovering what those value adds are?
It's difficult because we can't drive change to the pace we would like when it's not in our full control. And sometimes people are a bit slower, and industry overall is a lot slower than tech and startup. Yes. We are a startup.
Yes.
So it's a hard transition. It's one way it goes through education. It goes through training, and that's why we've built internal dashboards that allows them to understand, okay, which depot is a bit slower, where is the most efficient lane, where you've actually paid more than you could have if you had optimized your freight differently, rather than moving pallets, moving full truckloads. Mm-hmm. And so we provide a range of insights, allowing them to take the right decisions. Mm-hmm. And that's one way of helping. It's a constant collaboration, right? We're not just a supplier, we're a partner. And that's how we've seen, but that's also how we deliver our service.
I can hear from your words now, it's a very razor sharp focus here, right? Okay. Given your razor sharp focus and you needed to re-engage with your investors and then also seeing that market, you know, the VC market, what's changed? What's you know, what are you hearing through your network, through your grapevine sort of thing?
A lot has changed in such a way where people don't deploy money anymore. Like if you look at this year, it's probably one of the worst years in a long time where money has been deployed. And if you look at where they've been deployed, it's actually follow on to help their own portfolio companies survive, right? So there's not a lot of new investment in this market. A lot of the people working at VCs have a lot of spare time. So they still knock on your door, say, hey, can I learn about your business? Mm. But they don't deploy any cash. So I don't meet with VCs anymore.
Right.
It's a waste of time, in the sense that I know that it's not the right market. My own investors are far more hands-on because they have spare time. And the past 2 years, they were busy investing and deploying cash. And now most of their LPs, meaning their own investors, are saying, be cautious, don't deploy now.
Yeah.
And so they have more time to focus on helping their portfolio companies. For some of my investors, that is actually great. I've got some industry experts. I've got Jungle Ventures that invested in Blackbuck, which is a unicorn in India in our industry, invested in Wessex, which is again a unicorn almost in Indonesia. So they have a lot of experience. Some other investors, a bit less, to be very honest. But you got to cater for that. You have a board. I have got a board. And so now it's almost on a weekly basis. I've got informal catch-ups about what's happening, how we're dealing with the different surprises. I mean, it's part of the role as a CEO. You need to deal with that. It's very important to set the right expectation, to set the right tone. We're in a very strong financial position because I've raised $60 million not too long ago.
That's right.
So I don't need money for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
So at least they don't panic. But still, I have to deal with that.
How are you handling the pressure?
To be very honest, I find the hardest part is not one side of the pressure, is the fact that pressure comes from everywhere.
Yes.
And you might know that yourself personally, but I've got pressure from my board and I need to know what's happening. I need to reassure them. I need to give them comfort. But I need to do the same internally.
Yes.
So for whoever I talk to, I need to be strong and I need to have no doubts and I need to have the solutions, or at least no one is going to ask me how you're doing. I'm asking how they're doing. And that's the journey, right? You're it's very lonely on the top of the pyramid.
It's true.
And so for the investors, I've got to be that. For the employees, I've got to be more transparent, provide more clarity of objectives, have goals that are clear, and all of those things that you need to be fulfilled, but also to be the best version of themselves and efficient at work. So that's lonely. I've got to be very honest. And how I deal with that, I just got used to it, compartmentalized. I've got 3 kids that helps me get to fully move on when I get home.
Yes.
And anyway, like I can't complain, right? Just deal with it.
Three kids. Yeah, wow, yeah. That's okay. Yeah. That you like to keep busy.
Yeah, I do, actually. I do.
Going forwards now, regardless of what state of the economy is, and I know that's probably flippant to say, what is the biggest challenge outside the greater economics, you know, the macroeconomics, which, let's face it, neither you nor I can control? What is the biggest challenge for Offload to get to the next level in your current view?
It's a good question. It's hard to narrow it down to one, but if I have to give it a go, I feel like it's a bit of the chicken and the egg in what we do, right? In order to solve the market, we need to understand the supply side, right? If I had like a satellite view, or if I knew exactly at all times where all the trucks in Australia were, mm-hmm. where they're heading, mm-hmm. and what kind of availability they have in the truck, whether they're empty or whether they still have five pallets, just understanding capacity and understanding yes. with full visibility where they are would allow me to be the most efficient player through AI and machine learning in optimizing freight for all of our clients and for whoever else decides to join
yes.
us. And so at the same time, volume gets me visibility, meaning that the more volume we have from our shippers, the more I can then get data from my carriers and understand where they're operating, where they're going, because they work with me. And so there's a bit of the thing where I know that everything lies with the carrier. And if they're all using my telematics, all using my app or my device in the truck, they're all using my transport management software, then I could solve all their pain points, make them more profitable, and create massive amount of value for the shippers. So my focus is going to be here. And I've alluded to it earlier, but what we're doing to kind of make sure we create value for those guys, we actually provide financial services, right? We provide factoring, we provide like pay now, buy now, pay later kind yep. of services. We yep. provide overall financing for trucks, mm-hmm. factoring, as I said. We provide fuel cards, so the best deals out there that the long tail can't get because they don't have the bargaining power when yep. you have one truck versus 1,000 trucks.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
don't negotiate the same deals.
Absolutely.
The same with tires. And so I'm putting all of my effort towards creating value for the carriers, mm-hmm. which might seem counterintuitive because they're not paying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you tend to think that your clients are the one paying, but I've realized and come to realize that if I don't truly create value for the carriers, I'm not truly going to be able to create value for my
yeah.
for my shippers. And so I'm going to be focusing on that for the next at least 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get good data sets and reliable data,
yeah.
then I'm going to leverage that in order to create even more value for my clients and my shippers.
It's interesting you touch on, you know, helping the carriers, because, you know, invariably speaking, when you work in the landscape that is Australia, a lot of your suppliers will come from independents. You know, it has to come from independents. You know, sometimes the guy might be only driving one truck. Right. Coming from an ex-CH Robinson background, which, you know, made its mark in the US, they don't have any of their own assets. Mm-hmm. It's all subcontractors. I recall, you know, their biggest draw card was looking after their carriers, which giving the carriers cash advance on the loads that they were going to do and so forth. So making sure that they have enough money for fuel, because some of these carriers are running on such bare margins over the US where they don't even have, if the tire blew, they don't have any money for it.
Yeah.
So that's where Robinson did very well, is that they actually tapped into the market. They actually really understood their carriers and said, okay, this is what's missing for my carriers. And we're going to try to deliver that because, you know, obviously getting to a financial mm-hmm. type of thing, which in itself, if you're smart, can turn into its own product,
yeah.
right? So as you were saying that, it was like makes total sense. Is that where Offload is heading towards, if not already there?
Yeah, so we're on the journey. We're okay. already midway, or I don't know how yep. far off, but we have already created a lot of value there. But to your point, right, there's 24,000 owner operators, one guy, one truck, one ABN, mm. right? And out of the 50,000 odd trucking companies, like 98% of them have less than 10 trucks.
That's right.
So we've got a lot of small trucking companies that, first of all, don't have the means to invest in technology.
Yes.
Even if they did, they don't have the time because they still drive themselves. And you have this weird thing where they're the ones that create the most value, but they're the ones that suffer the most in the market.
That's right. That's
and so we pay in 2 days, for example, right? We do cash advance during peak because if you don't have any fuel in your truck, what are you going to do? You're not going to move the freight, though you're getting paid 60 days after.
Yes.
So
yes.
you incur a lot of the cost ahead of actually fulfilling the, yes. the freight,
yes.
and then you only get paid 60 days. So the working capital, super hard.
Right.
And if you have one unforeseen issue with a truck, maintenance for a month, maintenance for whatever happened, right? Or you had an accident.
That's right.
The entire company can go bust.
Not only go bust, I think the more human way to think about it is that it's their livelihood.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's a destruction of that human being. And a lot of the politicians don't get that. You know, if you've got 24,000 owner truck drivers who doesn't know where the next load's money going to come from, that's a lot of pressure. They probably, you know, have family, have kids and so forth. And that's the way we don't tap into it. And I think, like you said, when offload can provide that, let's call it a safety net, or so to speak, that has to be attractive.
It has to. And I mean, I like the fact that you brought back the fact that we're talking about people that have families, right? We're not just talking about numbers on an Excel spreadsheet, right? Yeah. We're talking about an industry that is core. There's a reason why we see this little yellow triangle at the end of each truck. Without trucks, Australia would stop, right?
That's right.
It's core, but it's not front of mind for most consumers.
Yes.
And when consumers are super happy to have all of their Christmas gifts and everything on the shelves around Christmas or around Boxing Day, they forget that there's been someone that hasn't been with a family working on to deliver that for Boxing Day. Right, and they all forget because it's normal to have everything on the shelf and we want things immediately. But that's a hard-working industry behind the scene doing it.
Absolutely.
That truck has been like driving 13 hours, right, overnight. Like that half an hour, we've got to understand some things here and adjust a little bit the expectation and have a bit more compassion towards those that actually do the work.
I keep on finding myself needing to explain what you just said to our customers, as well as to overseas agents, because what we have in here in Australia is very unique, because we have the landmass almost the size of USA. Mm-hmm. 26 million people, you know, the infrastructure is non-existent. Competition almost non-existent in some of the areas. These drivers, they've got a lot of land to cover. You know, last year I did a little bit of a sort of a half Australia tour. You know, I drove 16,000 kilometers in three weeks.
Pretty good.
And along the way, you know, I stopped at the truck stops and, you know, next to all the trucks, and I was, you know, in the truck stops talking to these drivers. You know, they were coming out in their shorts and singlets and thongs, you know, and I'm telling my journey. They go, yeah, we do that every week. And it's hard. It's really hard, and it's
lonely.
It's lonely, hard yakka. And the thing is, I was driving a ute. You know, my dog, sun was shining, right? But these guys were carrying road trains, you know? I mean, the 340s going at the back, road trains, and they do that every week. And we're sort of branching off topic a bit because this is very relevant. Mm-hmm. And then you look at some of the drivers, they're not the healthiest bunch, right?
Yeah.
And I go, well, why? And then I look at them, between stops, they don't have many options. And they go to these service stations, and the food that's being served there is just fried, and more fried. And their standard lunch would be a fried Chico roll or spring roll or a couple of dim sums. Something has to be done.
And we're not taking good care of them. But there's no industry standard, right? So it's down to every kind of trucking company to do the right thing with the drivers.
That's right.
And most of them try to, especially those that have, the bigger trucking companies tend to have employees as drivers. And we are seeing a pattern here of not the best behaviors being promoted. But in the long tail, the intentions are the purest, but the means are not there. And of course, like when a driver is making a couple hundred dollars a day, driving 13 hours, right? He will not pay for a hotel. He will sleep in the back of the truck.
That's
and
right.
So it's a tough life. And the one of our biggest challenge, and it's for everyone to have in mind, right, is that we don't have any renewal of drivers. The average age of a driver is increasing by 7 months every year,
Correct, which
means that there's no new drivers coming in.
That's right.
We are getting into a driver shortage. Immigration is not compensating for
it.
And even in this market where demand is a lot less than during COVID, we are still struggling to find drivers. There's
That's still right. A
bunch of trucking companies that have trailers or prime movers that are not moving because of driver shortage.
That's right.
And so we got to find a way to make that industry more attractive. And so we need to tackle the health point you've made, the accommodation point, or any other things that makes this industry hard to enter. And the license, for example, getting your license and having to wait for you to already be in the workforce in order to be able to drive a prime mover.
That's right.
How is that helping? Make it something you can have straight on, because then you can have someone enter that as a career move. Because we have driver shortage, a lot of companies will go bust.
Yes.
And we're going to face a big, big problem if we don't all
play
an active role.
That's right. And I think you've touched on something super important. And that's not only in the trucking sector. I think they mean many of the existing traditional sectors of employment where we simply don't get the talent coming through. At the best of days, logistics don't get its fair share of talent. You know, like we all fell into it in one way, shape or another, and we happen to carve something out of it. But when we go even granular into a trucker, there is no people coming up in the ranks to be customs brokers, right? So each year the customs broker is aging, and there's a whole batch of them retiring, and people just, there is no young talent coming through. So that's a crisis. We've got no more customs brokers, so the government has to re-engineer their way to open up the floodgates and let everyone declare themselves and put the border force into action. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't get people doing the work, what are you going to do? And now you're talking about the truckers. I can totally see that. We have a hard enough time hiring for people to come work in this office, which has got the harbour views and everything, right? Give them free coffee and free drinks. Would you want your kids to be a driver? No, I don't.
It's a tough one.
It's a tough one. So, like, how can you, like, you know, how can you make it attractive for someone to want to go drive that beast of a machine, covering the distance they do, where they don't have anyone around them? That's a, you know...
I think we've got to go back to fundamentals, because there's a reason why people enter that industry. At that time still, like, unemployment was still low, right? So there was a sense of freedom when you were a truck driver. I'm my own man and I will decide to go there and I will get work. And if I want to go to Wagga Wagga, I'll just call a couple of mates and I have a freight to come from Wagga Wagga to I don't know, Cairns. And then you go to Dubbo. And that was the sense of freedom. But I think with the constant increased expectation of improvement, of digital things, like, it's put so much pressure on the trucking companies and on the drivers that we've lost all the value that we were able to offer. I think there's something where we need to go back to fundamentals. We need to stop harassing truck drivers every 30 minutes when they're out of schedule to see where they are, and because it's a pain. We need to stop having them manage paperwork. If not, they don't get paid. Where's your pallet docket? You're not going to get paid if you don't have a pallet docket. Where is it signed? It's not signed in the white box. You need to go back tomorrow. Like, all of those things make it painful. I think we still have a couple of things that up our sleeves that we can do to improve it, make it better. And then we need to rely on associations. I think we need to rely on the government to find ways to have immigration. I don't believe in the renewal of the labor force in trucking based on local labor force. And I think that we need to find in other countries the talent. And the same way when we miss hairdressers in Australia, we make the visa very easy for hairdresser. Well, let's make that visa very easy for truck drivers. And let's go wherever it is around the world where talents are keen to come to Australia and improve their quality of life and help us support this economy.
Yeah. Again, you and I find ourselves to be the choir boys in the same church. You've hit the nail on the head, immigration. There's too few of us here in Australia for us to be truly a global player, tier one player. There's not enough, right? We can't expect everyone to have kids and, you know, to come up in a race. It's not quick enough. And it's something, I think, out of our control, but we can clearly see, sitting where we're sitting, that this is a huge problem. And I agree with you 100%. So given that, truck driver pay, where do you sit on that at the moment?
I think this one is a tricky one. Because I know that there's more and more noise being made in the industry, controlled by the biggest trucking companies, because for the bigger trucking companies to control wage is actually a way for them to control the market, because they then force employees, and if they had the way to impose a minimum wage, they could then win from that. So a lot of the lobbying being done towards that is actually not from the long tail. And if you remember the last time it had it happened in Australia, where they want to implement a minimum wage for trucking, who was down in the roads? Who was complaining? Not the biggest trucking companies, because for them, that would be a competitive edge. It was actually the smaller guys, because they lose the flexibility. It was the owner operators that are losing from it, right? Flexibility is what they offer their customers. And being able to be nimble in how they pay themselves, meaning charging more during high season, charging less during low season, charging a lot less for backload, because of course, when you come back empty, it's a lot of fuel you pay for nothing.
That's right.
So not going for minimum wage, but just covering your cost on the backloads is something that nimbleness is essential for the long tail to survive.
Yes.
And so minimum wage is not protecting them, it's actually threatening their existence. And so while we need to have standards that protect them, this is not the right one.
Right.
And I'm not saying that on their behalf, they're saying that themselves, right? And so we've seen this thing where the bigger trucking companies are pushing that in order to kill the long tail and to win the market. Because of course, and I won't name names, but I think you have them in mind, right?
There's only a few of them.
Those top trucking companies are doing that.
Yes.
And I think it's dangerous. I think we should listen to not the loudest people, but to the actual long tail of the trucking companies, the ones, the 98% that have less than 10 trucks. Let's listen to them carefully, because what they're saying is important. And they're the ones that livelihood that we should protect, not the big ones that are inherently like a duopoly almost, right?
I don't know of any trucking bodies of that advocates for this group of long tails mm-hmm. that you speak of? You know, I mean, there could be an opportunity for yourself to head up that, and that could be another adventure. But I think advocacy, as we have seen, is very important, you know, because we are an industry that is essential, rightly said, rightly so, but it's largely gone unnoticed and underappreciated because nobody is out there waving the flags and fighting the good fight and speaking the good word. And hopefully through interactions like this, you know, we bring some conversation to the table. So going on to talking about climate, because I can see that you are a member at Leaders for Climate Action. I'm right with you in terms of climate, of course, it's the only one we have. We better look after it. I agree with that 100%. But then we've got to put our commercial and realistic hat on at the same time. What is the mood? What is the tide? What is the, you know, wave going towards being more climate responsible when we talk logistics? What is both the tangible thing we can do and the holistic thing we can do?
You can't solve for what you can't measure. And I think the first step is understanding the impact that we have through supply chain on the environment. And so that's step one that I think all companies should go through. And then I'll go back to my comment around the long tail, because I don't believe that the transition will happen overnight. Like, is hydrogen ready? Mm-hmm. No. Is electric going to do long haul? Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. So we're at the crossroad between change, but how early do we go in that journey? Because it's not going to go now, and adoption is not going to happen now, because people, at the end of the day, they don't want to pay more. Those big trucking companies, they're going to be able to fund themselves. They're going to raise debt and then acquire the trucks that are the greenest versions that exist. Again, the ones that won't be able to do so are the long tails. The mom and pops out there, I'm not going to be able to invest in hydrogen trucks when they cost double the cost. Mm-hmm. They're not going to invest in widgets that are electric for metro work. Mm-hmm. They're just not going to do that because they can't financially have that burden without the guarantee right. of having work
yeah.
and that is charged more. And so when I'm part of Leaders for Climate Change, Climate Action, what I'm actually trying to do is make sure that I play a positive role. Through me, I can guarantee work. Mm-hmm. Through offload, I can then help that long tail go through the transition faster. Mm-hmm. And rather than being met by resistance, I'm being met by people that are keen because I guarantee work. And I say, you know what, if you move into a truck that is greener, or if you adapt your truck and your truck emits less, Euro 5 standards or whatever the standard is, even with diesel, like then we will help you get more work. And so what I believe that we should do in the industry is to say, well, let's use the aggregation and the hundreds of millions that we do kind of in freight to then help the transition for the long tail. We don't want the long tail to be waking up in 10 years mm-hmm. and no clients wants to work with them because they mm-hmm. can't mm-hmm. use old diesel trucks.
Yeah.
Because they will all die, but they have all good intentions. Yes. Again, going back to the fact that they're hardworking, good intentioned
yes.
people, but they just don't have the money to invest. So that is my journey in that transition and in making this net zero at some point, is that I want to be in the forefront, not because I believe that change will happen overnight, but because I believe that if I'm not, that long tail will end up suffering from the loss of competitive edge that they have against the bigger trucking companies.
Right, so very much a grassroots approach, would you say?
And baby steps, meaning like I'm part of a hydrogen conglomerate.
Okay.
When I mean, I talk about offload and yes. it's 140 employees, yes. and much more work than I
yes.
do. But offload is part of a conglomerate to bring hydrogen in Australia. So we partner with,
really?
With a bunch of companies.
Okay.
We've pitched to get to some grants in New South Wales,
right.
in Queensland and in Victoria.
Right.
And so we're trying to be part of that transition. Yes. We are investigating with some trailer rentals for how we can help and actually get some prime movers that are electric that can be moved.
Yes.
We are talking to some official bodies in Canberra to give data on all the telematics we have so that they can understand where to put recharging stations. So we are playing an active role, but it's still super early.
Hydrogen electric, which one?
So, I mean, it's a hard one. I'm not an expert. Overall, electric, the distance is the main challenge, and the recharging time and is a main challenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And unless we change to minimum driving hours, we'll be met with resistance because we'll miss the schedule, right? Because we'll have to recharge in the middle, and so that truck driver will be out of time and can't drive the second leg. Yes. And so when you're going to Brisbane, you'll have to recharge once, and then you can't continue driving because you're out of hours. So for long distance, I don't think it's feasible.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in it very much for short distance. I do believe that at some point lithium cost will continue to skyrocket.
Yes.
So we might have a long-term supply challenges.
Yes.
And how green is recycling lithium still needs to be proven over time.
Yes.
I do believe in green hydrogen. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why Fortescue and Andrew Fortescue is pushing very much on green hydrogen.
Right.
It's because, yes, it produces a lot of energy to produce hydrogen, but you can store it, you can make it liquid.
Yes.
It can actually serve aviation purposes as
right.
much as trucking purposes. Refueling is very quick.
Right.
So I believe that for everything that is related to Australia, hydrogen will always be more adopted
yes.
than electric.
I think Australia produces a lot of, I mean, we are one of the leaders in hydrogen
yes.
production, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Because I think we were building ships even to export. I think we had a trial export to Japan or something like that.
I haven't followed that, but I
yeah.
know that we have one of the most cutting edge hydrogen production, I think, in Queensland.
On the subject of electric, because I was actually read a good piece of article the other day, was explaining that for a prime mover to be running on electric, you need pretty much, because the amount of power it needs to be recharged, you need its own substation to recharge the truck. And that's not realistic. You're not going to build a substation
no.
for every prime mover out there. I would love, you know, someone maybe clever, smarter than me on YouTube to create some, with graphs and so forth, explain to us what these green technology is, rather than this, you know, big narrative catchphrases, and you know, and people get confused thinking that's the answer,
mm-hmm.
Because like you said, the best way towards a solution to a problem is to understand and to have the visibility and transparency. If you don't have transparency, what the hell are you trying to solve, right? And I think a lot of us understand that, and the push for electric, I think, has gone a bit narrative driven.
I think the push is healthy because we need to force it, and so if it's not adopted by a lot of people, it would always cost a lot more. So the mass going into electric, like cars, I think that is a great move. And I appreciate everyone who backed the early car makers of electric, because they forced change. And whether everyone was like, yeah, but you're charging it based on coal, electricity, who cares? Because you need that mass adoption in order to make the cost scale down
yes.
and have the volume to do so. In trucking, it's a bit more tricky. For the reason you've just said, I think in the US, they're trying to have the battery in the trailer so that they can have a drop and hook kind
yes.
of setup. But it's a hard one because the law is a certain truck has a maximum weight
yes.
on the roads because
yes, that's
the roads aren't meant to support any type of weight. And so when you know that a battery will take you 6-7 tons,
you lose your load.
You lose your load. And so you lose 6-7 pallets, right? And so you organically, beyond the cost of the truck that you need to amortize, you're having to bear for the fact that you can't move as much freight as you could.
Yes.
So either we need to change the infrastructure of our roads and make them stronger,
yes.
or the law itself altogether.
Yes.
But that will always burden electric.
Yes. We need more conversation on this topic so people can actually understand.
Yeah.
Now we've come full circle now. We earlier you were touching on you're an immigrant in this country, you know, you were driven to succeed, your support network wasn't there, or sort of, you know, it was difficult. I'm going to couple that with work-life balance, which I believe you all are also someone who's well spoken of in terms of that particular area. What is work-life balance to you?
So I'll tackle that question. I just don't want to complain being an immigrant, because being an immigrant, French, white, and so on, I think is one of the easiest immigration possible. Right?
Yeah.
There's immigrants from other cultures and other backgrounds that face much more resistance, and at least they need to prove a lot more.
Yes.
I'm super fortunate in the scale of what immigration can look like
yes.
as a French that have a Western culture. And also white, and not saying that there's racism, but still it helps. But to your point, I feel like it's a hard one to strike balance between work life when you start a business. And I think the two has to be a bit intertwined. I took 1 day off for my first, no, 0 day off for my first kid, 1 day off for my second kid, and 2 days off for my third one. And it's always been like that. And I work, this morning I woke up a bit early. I woke up at around 4, and I worked from 4 to 7, and then hit the gym for half an hour and then came to the office. Tonight, before going to bed, I'll for sure be on my emails for 1 hour. It's not much about your time, it's about managing your energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a theory that is super clear in my head, at least. You run out of energy way before you run out of time.
Yes.
And whoever tells me I don't have time is like, well, how much time did you spend on your phone today?
Yeah.
So it's not about how much time you have, it's about how much energy you can deploy. I'm lucky I don't have an energy problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what I focus on is more being fully attentive to what I do. If I'm giving dinner to my kids, I won't be doing something else. I'll be fully in the moment. So I don't quantify my moments by the amount of time spent, but by the quality of them. And so for that reason, I spend a lot of time at work and constantly think of work and dream of work. I woke up my wife this night talking about a fictive meeting with my board.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to my board, and I woke myself up and woke her up. So work is constantly in my head. But at the same time, when I'm with my kids, with my wife, I'm in the moment. I don't waste it. And so I segregate super well there.
Prior to COVID, it was work-life balance. You know, this is when you work, this is when you off work. But then we went into COVID, everybody got locked down, and then we have the new slogan now, which is work from home. Yeah. And the paradigm shift between the two is not in day in black and white, right? It's the same group of people, and I say that with the greatest respect, without any nastiness, that's drumming the working life balance to now going to for the work from home narrative. And I was like, well, you can't have it both ways. Before you say you don't want to take work home, now you want to bring work home and say that's the new reality. Which way is it? You know, tell me which way, where do you stand as opposed to just always finding the easy way out, you know? And you put it so succinctly and so nicely when you say it's not about time, it's about energy. And I think I've not heard anyone say it or bring that level of thinking to this conversation. And how we define our energy has to come from our purpose, our daily purpose and our daily drive. And if we're in the right profession and we've thought about it and we're doing something we love doing, you're going to have ample amount of energy, right? Time is no longer a consideration. It's like, I'm going to work until I'm like, got to eat or got to sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Because that is your existence, because you have a purpose. I guess to the young folks out there who are all into this working from home narrative without really clarity of mind to think through what the hell they're really saying, what's your opinion or viewpoint or advice?
I think there's something super healthy in the new generation that challenges everything, right? Mm-hmm. It comes with pain as an employer, right? Mm-hmm. And you must know that. But it's an ever-demanding generation, and you're like, oh, when are you giving back? But what if I'm thinking back to what it means for them is that I love the fact that they've asked themselves a lot of questions. What do I want? What makes sense for me? And so those questions end up usually for a transition period and through discovery and actually work, they end up understanding what they will like doing. And when you like doing something, to your point, you do it without counting. Whether it's counting the hours, but the hours is just the one element of the variable, right? Because between someone that does 9 to 5, that loves his job, and someone that does a 9 to 5, that hates his job, the output can be a 2x difference.
That's right.
So it's not only the hours, it's the amount of energy you can deploy and the amount of focus you have and passion you have in your job. So in that sense, I love the challenge that the generation is asking themselves. One thing though, and you asked me a piece of advice I would give to any young workforce, I was still in the last generation where I needed to work, and when I was in private equity, or in my first internship, or I was in the hedge fund, you're just the last one to leave the office. And that's how it is, because you prove that you're capable of working, and then you get to have things given to you, whether it's a promotion, whether it's a bonus, whether it's trust on bigger projects.
Yes.
I think now everyone has a feeling of being entitled to all those things without proving it. There's a part of it that is healthy. There's another part where they need to be reminded that actually, like, you still need to prove something. You still need to go out there. You still need to give yourself. Work-life balance is essential, but you're still going to give so much time in the workspace that you got to make it important. You got to give your 100%, and 80% is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. And if 80% is sufficient to you, you're in the wrong field.
Exactly. Yeah.
Choose the field in which you want to give 100%. If not, you'll be disappointed. If you're focusing on what you're going to do outside of work and how quickly the day is over, it's 5:01, you're like, oh, finally, I'm out. I'm going to head to the gym. It's like, well, ask yourself the right question.
Yeah.
Because if you're unhappy to the point in which you're counting the minutes, you're wasting your life away.
Yes.
So that generation, focus on finding your purpose, finding what makes you happy, or where you're learning, or where the learning curve is keeping you engaged. Stay in environments that fosters that culture for you, but give a bit more.
And this is why, in the short time of less than 10 years, from someone coming from finance to coming to our industry and to raise $100 million.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of luck in the middle. Yeah.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time. It has
pleasure
been an absolute pleasure. It was probably one of the most thought-provoking, engaging conversations, and I can feel the passion that you have for this industry, and it's a rare commodity. All right? And I've speak to a lot of folks before we started this, and you know, throughout my career, who's been in the game a lot longer than both of us had together, who doesn't speak with 1% of your energy and your passion.
Appreciate
thank you so
that.
Much
thank
for
you
your
very
time.
Much. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.